Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the founder and editor of the New Books Network. I've published several academic books, and one of the things I found frustrating is my inability to get them picked up in the press. There really is no PR service specifically oriented toward academic books. Recently, however, I had the opportunity to work with a PR firm in New York, RLM, on a book that I recently published. And I have to say, they did a remarkable job at a very low price. And this got me thinking. I wonder if the New Books Network and RLM could provide a service that would promote academic books. So the folks at RLM and I put our heads together and we came up with a package. It is specifically targeted toward people like you, people who write academic books. So if you're interested, you should go to the NBN website and click publish. Publicize your book, and there you'll find some information about the services that the NBN and RLM are offering. What we really want to do is provide you with value for money. As far as we know, no such service exists. This is the first of its kind, and we really hope it is successful, and we hope that it helps you get the word out about your academic book.
Welcome to the New Books Network.
Hello, everyone, and welcome back to New Books in History, a podcast on the New Books Network. I'm Yana Byers, your host, and I'm here today with Stefano Tutino, professor and the Peter Rail Chair in European History at UCLA, to talk about her new book, A Fake Saint in the True Church, the story of a forgery in 17th century Naples, out this year, 2021, with Oxford University Press. Hello, Stefania.
Come sta? Hi, Yana. Bene, tu? How are you doing?
Super. It's a beautiful
Congratulations
day.
Congratulations for the year Italian.
That's pretty basic. It gets worse after that, I promise.
We'll just stop there then.
Yeah, let's let that go. How's Los Angeles this morning?
Beautiful, as usual. Another day in paradise, as they say. Same weather all the time.
Yeah.
I know I'm jaded. I know I shouldn't do that. It's a beautiful place. We're very lucky.
It's fair. Whatever. It's your thing.
You get very jaded after a while, you know.
Yeah.
Another day. 75 and sunny.
Oh, yeah. Wow, that sounds terrible. All right. Our first job today is to put this current work in your trajectory and explain kind of how you came to write it. So your first book, way back in 2007, right? Law and Conscience, Catholicism in Early Modern England. 1570 to 1625, kind of starts you down your path as an historian of the Reformation era. And then your second book, which is 2008, Thomas White and the Blackwellists, Between Politics and Theology During the Civil War, continues in that vein, right? And it's also an exploration of English Catholicism, which is an interesting choice. Very few people work on English Catholicism, and fewer still of them are Italian.
Yeah, I think I wanted to... I don't know, you know, I mean, I am fascinated by the history of Catholicism, but it's, you know, if you work in Italy on Catholicism, I found it a little oppressive because, you know, it's very sort of, so to study it outside, it was sort of liberating intellectually. Mm-hmm. And it's also, you know, I grew up in a small town. I wanted to see the world and England felt like a whole world. And so sure. I wanted to...
Yeah, it's far. It is very far away.
From Sicily. Very far away place. Yeah. And so, yeah, so that was part of it, you know, to feel some freedom, geographical, but also intellectual, to explore something without kind of like the pressure of being in a Catholic dominated country.
Yeah. And it's, I mean, it's a story that doesn't get enough attention. So it's good.
Yeah, see, no, that's true. Yeah. No, I think so. Yeah. I definitely think so.
But then you moved to the continent in 2010, right? Empire of the Souls, Robert Bellarmine and the Christian Commonwealth 2013, Shadows of Doubt, Language and Truth in Post-Reformation Catholic Culture, and then Uncertainty in Post-Reformation Catholicism, which was 2017. And this speaks to the culture of the Reformations more broadly, right?
Yeah.
And so I'm seeing like this career-long interest in a really long-standing interest in Reformations, like the era of Reformations kind of writ large, right?
Yeah.
And in a Catholic way, Protestant areas, small c Catholic, Protestant areas as well as the Catholic areas. Yeah, so that's a fair characterization.
Yeah, I would say.
And there's a consistency here. And then this book represents a bit of a departure though, right? If not in subject matter, at least a methodology.
Yeah.
So how did you come to do this? What happened?
I think, you know, the last books that you mentioned have this common theme about uncertainty and truth. And that's something I'm interested in exploring sort of in the culture of the Reformation era, but it's also something I'm interested in exploring as a historian. You know, we all sort of traffic in the business of truth. You know, we aim to tell something true about the past, but what does it mean? What the extent of it is? So that's sort of the general interest. And then I just stumbled across this case where I was looking for something else completely in the archive, entirely by chance, as sometimes it happens. And I thought, this is an incredible story. And it does speak to the question of truth and what kind of truth. And so I decided to follow through. And then once I did that, I realized that it required a different style, so to speak, because it is a beautiful story. And so finally I could sort of put into practice, you know, kind of like in a meta way, my interest for truth as a historian by taking advantage of narrative more than I've done in the past. And also I should say, I was teaching this class to freshmen on the history of the Inquisition, and it started very sort of traditionally, but then I could see that just they weren't into that. And so I started talking about the story, and they started to sort of be fascinated by it. And so we started this dialogue, and I workshopped with my students, undergraduates, yeah, part of that book.
Very cool.
Yeah, and so it was also a gift to them, you know, to pay them back, if you like, for what they gave me, which is the kind of enthusiasm and the kind of, you know, curiosity. And yeah.
Yeah, we like, they love, like, students will do what you know, they will really get into some things. They will do this work. Yeah.
Oh, they do. And, you know, they were my most careful readers. They were, you know, asking questions that I never thought about, but they were incredibly good and insightful ones. So this book is sort of, is the fruit of that collaboration, if you like. I mean, it really was sort of, it grew up in the classroom, if you like.
That makes so much sense, because one of the questions I wanted to ask you is kind of what your audience is, because this is a really readable book.
See, I want it to be readable because, you know, English is not my first language. You know, it's hard to write readable prose. It's easier to hide, you know, behind the jargon. But readable prose is a wonderful thing. And again, like, to see my students understanding this. And, you know, it really is the concepts themselves don't need to be said in a difficult way in order to be reachable. And so it was, I don't know, it was very, writing this book was the hardest thing I've ever done. Because like I said, writing simply takes a lot of care and work. And so I'm very grateful to my editor who helped me. And, you know, she was a very good sounding board saying, yeah, this phrase, do we want to rephrase it? Yeah.
Okay.
And then my students, I would ask them and they would be like, eh. And so, you know, to find that medium where they really kind of like got into the language, it was very rewarding. And I learned a lot. I mean, I really did learn a lot writing this book.
I can imagine. Yeah, that's great. I mean, so it's microhistory. And so, and that has been criticized widely, widely. And I'm wondering, what made you decide to do that? Like, how did you get how do you feel about the microhistorical question?
I think that most of the criticism is fair in the sense that the kind of ideological and historiographical context in which microhistory was born is no longer ours, you know, and I take the point of the critics of microhistory, the Eurocentrism, the kind of like, you know, history from below, if you like. I understand that this is all being done in a different way. But the one thing that microhistory does, I think two things that are still very relevant is one, the relationship with primary sources. The fact that you really have to get intimate with the primary source to do microhistory. And I think that is still something that we do as historians and we should do more of, because I think it speaks to, you know, it teaches a humility, listen to the sources, the kind of dialogue that happens between the past and the present, I think is still pretty much at the core of the profession. And then the second thing that microhistory does is that question of historical imagination and narrative is part of it. There is a certain humility in it. You know, there are holes in the past that we cannot fill. But yet we have historical imagination that can help us connect with the past in a way that is not artificial, and it's very sort of, you know, authentic to the enterprise really of being human. You know, this is even beyond being just a historian. So I think those two things, the relationship with the primary source and narrative as a way to explore historical imagination, I think they're very, they speak to me, you know, still, even though many of the things that spoke to early microhistorians don't speak to me any longer. And so I wanted to try this genre without the kind of ideological context and really for those two things.
Wonderful. Yeah. It speaks, though. I mean, right, when I think about when I started to love history, when I fell in love with history, it wasn't, I was not doing like theoretical analysis. I was falling in love with stories and people who had lived in the past. And that is microhistory and like these deep dive into a small set of documents really gives you the feel it. You can feel it. You get back to that. And I think it's wonderful for classrooms. I mean, that's, it speaks to students. I give microhistories to friends who are not historians. I'm like, here, read, who doesn't want to read The Cheese and the Worms, right? Who doesn't want to read like The Return of Martin Guerre?
Yeah.
It's two movies, you know? So,
and it's good, you know, because we always say, you know, history is relevant, but what is it that is relevant about history? And I think what you said, you know, it's about like feeling close and yet distant to what people who lived in different contexts. And I think that is something that everybody should sort of get into it. And microhistory is an excellent entryway. And I think it's, I mean, I did fall in love with the stories too.
It's where people lived.
Mark Bloch used to say that, you know, that the most important ingredient in history, historiography is humans. Otherwise, we'll be antiquarians. And he didn't say it disparagingly, but, you know, there is a difference between antiquarians and historians. And historians like humans. You know, they study humans in the past. They don't study things in the past. And so that kind of component of humanity, I think the stories make it very vivid.
And I think it's what we have to offer as a discipline to the world that,
I agree.
That the world really needs.
I agree. I'm really big, you know, the more I think about this, the more I do think that historical compassion, if you want, for our fellow human beings, I think that's the lesson we have to offer. Because, you know, what people say the past is a foreign country, it is true. You know, the kind of habit to understand alterity and diversity, you have to use it as a historian of the past because those people are not like you. You know, they don't believe in the same things that we do. And I think to learn how to interact with those people in the past with different values, with different, very different values. I think it's something that teaches us a lot about, you know, engaging with people who are different from us in the present even.
Yeah, very much so. Yeah, valuable lesson. Are you listening, people? Are you listening out there? Support the humanities and history in particular.
Yay, go humanities, yeah.
Woo, it's true.
Shout out to the humanities.
It's so simply, it's like the idea that humanities are being cut is just so nonsensical. Like, what are we supposed to be doing in university?
I know, but at the same time, I think it's on us, you know, to be more upfront and to be more open and to tell people more. Why is it incredible to be lucky enough to study this for a living and to, you know.
Why are you so lucky to get to do it in class, even if it's the one class you're taking while you're learning to build cars or whatever, you know?
Exactly. That's why I love, you know, I love teaching, you know, introductory courses for people who are not majoring in history. And I feel very privileged and honored. You know, I have engineers in my class. That's the one class of history they're going to take, and they pick me. I feel like this incredible responsibility, and it's incredible. See, you know, it really is wonderful if you think about this.
I fully agree with you, obviously. All right. So speaking, you talk about your relationship with your source material. Tell me about it. So you just stumbled upon this, I'm assuming. You just ran in Big Folio. What happened?
No. So, you know, I was in the Inquisition archive. And so, you know, there is a set of sources in the Inquisition archive. They're called the Creta, and they are the minutes of the meetings. So, you know, for every day that they met, they would write, you know, we discussed the case of X. That's what we decided. And I was just reading, looking for something else. And there is a lot of references to this saint, And I never heard of this saint myself. So I'm like, what is this saint? Who is these people? What are they talking about? But I ignored because I was looking for something else. But the references kept popping up. And so I said, okay, now stop. I have to find out who are they talking about. And that's where it started. And then I went to the other sources, other libraries, and I looked for stuff. And that there it was, you know, this incredible story kind of taking shape. And I never knew. I mean, it's really beautiful. My ignorance was immense. But it turned out it was an important case, and, you know, relatively speaking, you know, it kept the congregation of the Index and the Inquisition occupied for more than 20 years. I mean, you know, it had ramifications in politics.
That's a deal. Yeah.
See, no, it was, you know, kind of like a big deal, so to speak, you know.
Amongst this, in this world. Yeah.
See, and in this world, and, you know.
I think it's interesting that you could have never heard about this person, and then all of a sudden it dominates your life for X number of years, right?
No, that's all, that's what usually happens.
Okay. Yeah. And so as discussed, it's a small story, but it's a big case, and it speaks to a lot of historiographical debates, right? So you contribute to the conversation on the ongoing culture of the Reformations. What else do you think you're doing here?
Well, I think I'm talking about the difference between sort of, you know, a theological truth, a historical truth, the rise of historical criticism, if you like, the rise of the culture of facts as opposed to fiction, if you like, the question of belief. What does it mean to believe that something is true? In what sense? The different meanings of the word belief. You know, microhistory, one thing that they do, you know, people think they do small things. I mean, the best microhistorians, you know, you mentioned Carlo Ginzburg or Natalie Zimon Davis, they use the small things to say something big. And so that's the hope, you know, to use this small story in a way to say something about historical imagination, about truth, about belief, about facts versus, in this case, theological, doctrinal, absolute truth.
This tension between truth and fact is a tension in itself, but then what we can know and how we can sort it out is something, is an interesting question, and we keep coming back to it already. And it's something that you discuss kind of openly in, you know, you really engage within the book, that when you tell this story, you fill in some gaps with possible options. Yeah. And this is also a move that sometimes can receive criticism. You don't know that. Yeah. But you do it, and effectively. And why do you do this? Can you tell us about that?
Yeah, I think that, you know, I take the criticism, but I also think that, you know, ignorance is always present in any kind of historical inquiry. But at the same time, like I said, we have historical imagination. As long as you don't blur the line, and I pay a lot of attention in that book to differentiate the things that I do know, because I have the evidence and I have the documents, and I think that I imagine based on, you know, what you would call educated guess, you know, based on what I know about the context. As long as you don't blur the line between those two, I think that both of them are critical to historical inquiry. I find historical imagination important, but not a substitute for documentary criticism and factual truth. But I think the interplay between those two, I think it's what makes us humans. You know, it's sort of an existential position, if you like. That I wanted my work as a historian to reflect authentically. That's all we live our life with. You know, we know a bunch of things, we imagine a bunch of things, and that kind of interplay between those two makes our life, frankly, worth living. Otherwise, it'd be either a crazy, completely unattached to reality, or it would be dry and...
So boring.
See? So,
yeah. But I mean, and we tell ourselves stories while we're living, right? You are continually engaged in this process of making your life real for yourself. This is a natural and rational.
Of course, you know, you have to make sense of things. You know, events that happen are constantly, we constantly put them in some kind of story, you know, to make sense of them. Otherwise, it's just a collection of trite, casual events. But that's not how we live our life. No.
And it makes good sense to do that for your subjects as well. And I mean, let's be clear, these are educated guesses, right? You're not just making it up.
No. I mean, that's the difference between a good scholarship and a bad scholarship, I think. That's sort of,
And I mean, you well understand, as well as anyone can, the mentality. And I mean, mentality and mentalité of this era. Right. Yeah. You know what people are thinking. You've read their words. You know this stuff.
Yeah. You know, it doesn't mean I cannot make mistakes. But I think to the best of my ability, those guesses come from my knowledge of the past, not from my, say, knowledge of myself. You know, nobody cares about myself. But
And what makes sense to me is not what made sense to someone in 1650. Yeah. Right, that we just don't have that.
You know, and again, you know, it's the alterity I'm talking about. You know, you have to make the effort of putting yourself into the shoes of people who lived, you know, 500, 400, 600, years ago in a different context where they believe in different things. And, you know, when my students, this comes up a lot. You know, this is a society for which religion matters in a way that is not true any longer in the Western secularized world. You know, the transcendent perspective is, in fact, influencing everything that they do in a way that it doesn't to you know, my student, you know, 21-year-olds in 21st century America, they don't live like this. And so their effort needs to be made because otherwise you don't understand.
No, and we all need to understand that we have an equally overarching, this idea we have an authority that we believe explains everything. It's just a different one.
Yeah, exactly. You know, being a historian helps you to do that, you know, to realize that whatever kind of explanatory principle a society uses, it's a historical creature in and of itself. You know, there is no given that there is no given that we end up discovering in the end, and that's the truth. And they just didn't get it. It's just a product of different historical circumstances.
It's such a great narrative, that progress narrative, that there's this, that we're the end of the story, right?
Wouldn't be nice.
Wouldn't it be great, but yeah.
And then you get a violin. Yeah, I know, but yeah. Historians cannot believe that because you cannot. I mean, you really are incapable of believing in that fully if you take your job seriously as you know.
Which I find comforting. I find the knowledge that in 200 years, should there still be people on this devastated planet, that we will seem ridiculous. They will think what credulous fools they were. And I find that very comforting.
I find it fascinating and cute, you know, and sort of, I have fun with this a lot. I have a lot of fun. Yeah, I mean, to live like the last, Highland, the last immortals would be very boring, I find. There's nothing to discover,
too.
You know, this is it. And
I got to say, this might be a podcast. It might be a New Books Network first for me, a Highlander reference. That's brilliant. I'm happy.
I'm an inexhaustible source of reference from the 80s. Anything cheesy from the 80s, come in.
Yeah. I will remember this, the person I call. Okay.
Anytime.
So, you know, we've talked about it. Let's talk about this story, because it's a great story. Who's Carlo Cala?
Oh, Carlo Cala was this, you know, man with great ambitions and a mover and shaker, you know, like this guy that showed up. I mean, you know, he was from a relatively wealthy family, but he wanted to make it big. So, you know, they send him to Naples, where he becomes like a big dude in the viceregal government. But his dream is to be a nobleman. He was just a nouveau riche, very rich, to be honest, but still, you know, nouveau. So he wanted to be to claim some kind of nobility. And just so it happens that research is being done to uncover this ancestor of his, who was a medieval soldier. They became, you know, one of the right hands of the emperor, Holy Roman Emperor, but he also ended up being a saint. And he was excited by this discovery. And so he tried to get this ancestor sort of canonized and fully recognized as the noble saint that he really was. And that's sort of where the story unfolds.
So, why is it important to him to be a nobleman? Is this,
See, no nobility. And, you know, in America is, that's another thing that my students always say, well, what do you mean? You know, because true, you know, America was born on the sort of, you know, on the wave of the Enlightenment and the equality of all men. But pre-modern world didn't work that way, right? So in pre-modern world, people who are noble, they are special. Nobility confers some kind of special characters and some special recognition that no other personal quality can match. And there were some dissenting voices, you know, people who said it doesn't matter who your family is from, it matters what you did, you know, Dante, and now this is the big anniversary of Dante, was one of those people who believed that what you have in your heart matters more than what you have in your family tree. But those were minorities, you know, in pre-modern Europe in general, the more noble your ancestor was, the better your family was, the more prestige and advantages you could claim. And Carlo Cala was one of those people who, like many, many others, wanted a piece of that, you know.
So what is it he finds exactly?
He finds evidence that, you know, in 12th century, there was a sort of an ancestor of his who did this incredible feats of strength. He was a giant. He killed, you know, hundreds of men with his bare hands. And so because of that, the emperor sort of left him in charge of the Calabria region, which is the southern Italian region where the family was from. And then he gets wounded, this, you know, 12th century ancestor, and an angel saves him. And he decides to just give up everything and become a hermit. And then he acquires all this charisma and special power, so he can cure the sick people, he can resuscitate the dead, and then he dies a holy death.
Eat stress-free this spring with Factor's delicious, ready-to-eat meals. Every fresh, never-frozen meal is chef-crafted, dietitian-approved, and ready to eat in just 2 minutes. Choose from a weekly menu of 35 options, including popular options like Calorie Smart, Keto, Protein Plus, or Vegan and Veggie. Get chef-prepared meals on the table in 2 minutes with Factor's ready-to-eat meals, so you can go back to doing what you love this spring. Looking for gourmet meals? Try meals that feature premium ingredients like filet mignon, shrimp, truffle butter, broccolini, and asparagus. And this is the part I really like. No fuss, no mess meals. Factor meals eliminate the hassle of prepping, cooking, or cleaning. You simply heat and savor the good stuff. Factor is the solution for fast, premium meals without the need for cooking. Head to factormeals.com/NBN50 and use code NBN50 to get 50% off your first box plus 20% off your next box. That's code NBN50 at factormeals.com/NBN50 to get 50% off your first box plus 20% off your next box while your subscription is active.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, that's an ancestor to want, right? The fighter.
Yeah. Well, so, you know, a giant. I mean, you know, there is a whole like sort of spin-off of the story that I speak about in the book that deals with giants, you know, the existence of giants, because this guy was supposed to be a giant. Courageous man, super soldier, political leader, saint, hermit, miracle worker. I mean, as far as ancestors go, like, you hit the jackpot, which is what he thought. It was like, oh my God, you know, what the hell? Like, finally, you know, this is it. This is my...
Yeah, you rarely get all that in one guy. And yeah, I mean, and that moment, that conversion moment, that's really important to like the story of the saint, right?
Yeah.
All the good ones have them. We can talk about Francis's. We can talk
precisely. You know, he had all the, so this, you know, 12th century guy, Giovanni, had all the making of an incredible story, you know, if he only had been real.
If only. It's a small.
If he had all just existed, you know.
Small problem. Perfect.
Yeah.
Little wrinkle in the story is that this guy isn't actually real. Okay. No. So then, but the way this comes together is pretty great, because it's not just that, like, that Carlo is doing this. Mount Vesuvius gets involved in his story.
Exactly. No, I mean, it is an incredible story. You know, it is a fascinating world, the early modern world, precisely because of this. You know, you see prodigies, and even nature sometimes gives you a hand or not, as the case might be. But again, this is part of a universe in which those things are all linked. And so it's just, you know, a good fortune that, you know, Vesuvius erupts. Just at the right time, creating this little prodigy, just at the right time, and bang, you know, like the whole thing seemed to conjure up a perfect scenario for this incredible saint to finally be recognized after centuries of oblivion.
Yeah, which is interesting in itself, right? And the idea that this guy would not have been known is kind of difficult to swallow, which, you know.
From the point of the church hierarchy to begin with, you know, and, you know, that's another thing that I always find fascinating. You know, there is this sort of myth that my students, and, you know, a lot of people have, you know, of the Catholic leaders in the early modern world being interested in covering up. They didn't think straight. They didn't think logically. They didn't think scientifically. They just wanted propaganda. You know, they just wanted their saints to be drummed up. But that's not true. And in fact, the first people who thought, wait, this thing stinks, were actually the leaders of the church. So Carlo Cala thought they were going to be ecstatic to have found yet another saint. But they thought, wait a minute, this guy we never heard of. Is he really likely, plausible that he was such a famous big guy, perfect saint, and yet nobody has ever heard anything until the 17th century. And so that kind of hint, you know, hermeneutics of suspicion, as it were, the first people to bring it up were, in fact, the leaders of the Catholic Church.
Yeah. And this is an important message as well, that, like, our students, nobody understands. The idea of the Inquisition is just it's ridiculous. You know, when I tell my students that there was due process.
Exactly. And they were first tribunal to actually engage with the limitation of torture, for example, you know, not the benefits, the limitation of it. You know, they were the first people to, you know, openly in treatises say, hey, you know, people under torture would say anything. Are you sure you want to go there? You know, there is not to deny the effects of the Inquisition, tragic effects on the communities, you know, in the cultural life. But nevertheless, you know, it's not like, you know, people think Inquisition is half secret chamber, half police, half torture, you know, theater. But really, it was a tribunal with quite a sophisticated understanding of legal process. And you know, they weren't dumb. I mean, that's the thing. Like, you know, they weren't stupid. They weren't, like, blinded by this faith that made them say things that they weren't true. They had all the interest to be thorough because their job was to preserve the truth of Catholicism from falsity, including falsehoods that came from faking things that weren't real.
Yeah, including beneficial falsehood. And, you know, and so, but this is possible. This is possible for a body of people to have a very strong belief, to believe that the eruption of a volcano that makes, you know, that spews ash and in like that makes crosses is important, right? That all matters. That is also evidence. But is this paper really old?
Right? Exactly. So with the same breath, they could believe that Mount Vesuvius gives crosses, you know, like dispenses crosses randomly, but they also were interested in saying, is the handwriting of this manuscript fake or not? Is the paper right or not? And, you know, in the Vatican Library, there is actually some still of these manuscripts that were forged, and it's amazing. You know, when we were kids and you used to, like, with the lighter burn the paper to make it look old, that's exactly what they did. I mean, what Carlo Cala did, it was just like, it looks like it burned with a candle, you know, to just make it the edges a little bit old looking. Right. But yeah, so yeah, in the same breath, those cardinals would say, yeah, you know, Mount Vesuvius is operated by God, and by the way, this paper is fake and the handwriting is not right, and the ink is not old enough to be 12th century.
Pretty amazing. Yeah.
It's
so Vesuvius, one superstar that shows up in this book, and then also Joachim Fiore shows up.
Yeah, so Joachim of Fiore is quite a character. So, you know, he is the, today still, you know, so a 12th century hermit, object of much veneration and love and belief on the part of, you know, people in southern Italy, especially. And, you know, I'm from Sicily, so I'm next door to Calabria, and I'm privy to that kind of enthusiasm for Joachim of Fiore. But then again, he's also a kind of a weird guy. He got condemned by a pope. I mean, not him, but some of his work were condemned by a pope. Some people think he was just kind of nuts. And some people, meaning even some popes or some, you know, cardinals, to the point that this canonization procedure is still open. It was supposed to be closed any day now. I mean, you know, people are waiting to see if he's really making it as a saint or not. But it was real. B, it was famous. And so when this story of the fake guy started to circulate, they got it linked to the story of Joachim of Fiore, who is unquestionably real and was unquestionably the object of much veneration. But he's another character that deserves a lot of attention because he's quite an amazing character. He's one of the few, you know, to be like in, you know, when people list the saints or blessed or miraculous, you know, workers in the church, he is one of them. But then there are catalogs in which people list heretics, and his name also appears in that as well. Because for some people, that's who he was.
He's definitely borderline, right? He definitely
He's definitely borderline. I mean, you know, and when you go there, I would love for people to, like, go to Calabria, to the mountains, the Sila Mountains inside of Calabria. It's a very, very unbeaten, you know, off the beaten path, you see, if you like. But then you feel the weirdness, the kind of borderline, the kind of world in which things are really borderline, miraculous, but also super creepy and devilish at the same time. You know, you feel it almost in the air.
Oh, interesting. Yeah, that is actually on my vacation list.
It's an incredible place, this whole sort of mountain. You know, because people who go to southern Italy usually go for the beaches, which is great because there's incredible beaches. But the mountains inside the southern edge of the Italian peninsula, they are really wild. Senses.
See, what? Listen to this, people. You learn about books and you get vacation tips.
Yeah.
This is an excellent podcast.
Yeah. Great food as well.
Yeah. So, but I mean, the story, it also, there's a resonance here, right? There's the hermit condition, the, like, the sanctity. And so it's wise to link them.
Yeah, but it's also, you know, I think there is also a story about center and periphery, you know, things from Rome. I mean, think about this. Rome is like the metropolis where all the intellectuals are, where all the theologians, the big, you know, knowledgeable people. But then when you get to the edge, in these tiny little villages, in tiny little communities, what from Rome looks borderline and suspicious and kind of like not really kosher, when you get to the periphery, those heroes are important for the community. And so you get a lot of that, you know, a sense of really the diverging interest from the center of the Roman world, you know, for where all the leaders are. They think one thing, but then when you get to the little communities, then people, you know, so the veneration for Gioacchino da Fiore, Joachim of Fiore, it's a good example of that. From Rome, everybody's like, yeah, really? It's borderline, it's not. But there, in the local community, it fulfills a role. You know, his monastery is still being visited by people. People, you know, when they want to pray for some kind of, you know, grace, they pray to him. They don't pray to a famous saint they have no connection with, so to speak. They'd rather pray to the guy that is not yet a saint, that is kind of borderline, because they feel it belongs to the community. So there's a lot of sense of the community taking ownership of these local figures. Mm-hmm. And Rome has to, you know, deal with that. You know, they might not like it. They don't like it sometimes, but that's what sort of their subjects, quote unquote, want. They want a local person that they feel close to.
Yeah. And the Romans are so dismissive of the country folk.
Yeah, but, you know, like if you are like the leader of the Catholic Church, I mean, you know, today, if you go to Vatican State, you realize how small it is. You know, there is few selected people who are supposed to run the whole of Christendom. So, you know, there is a selection effect. You know, you don't make it to the Vatican unless you have a high threshold for belief. But then again, you know, people who are on the ground, they have a different threshold for belief.
Sure. And you don't make it to the Vatican if you are not a very learned, very intelligent, this is the height of the intellectual world in some way.
Exactly. You know, that's what my, you know, I always tell my students, they really want to be on top of things. You know, the leaders of the Catholic Church in the pre-modern world, they don't want to be left behind. They are reading up on, you know, scientific advancement. They are reading up. They are like, you know, au courant, because they cannot afford to lose track. They kind of afford to be left behind. So they are not just, you know, very learned, but they're also sort of cutting edge learned, quote unquote. You know, they're sort of at the front for of their discipline, because they need it. You know, if you want to run the church, you want the church to stay relevant. You have to keep on, you know, kind of moving forward.
And I mean, this is like, we've talked a little bit about this, but I really want to stress this, that like, these are people the Inquisition in particular, terrible reputation, but I mean, all of the people, the whole of the people of the Curia, these are people who are not credulous fools. Yeah. They are very smart and they're very interested in what they view to be the truth. Right.
Exactly. They're not credulous fools. You said it perfectly well. You know, they are not credulous and they're not fools. They need to be not to be credulous, because the future of the church depends on them. You know, if you just say things that aren't true and people find out, then you lose credibility. And this is not something that they can afford. They're supposed to keep the church true and credible. And this is something that, you know, that needs to be stressed, I think. The truth and credibility, they are both very present in the mind of the leaders of the church, the whole Curia. They are interested in this point in time to assert the truth of religion, but also to show its credibility. Mm-hmm. And so I think that's important.
Yeah, I mean, and that's part of the response to the Protestant. There are responses to Protestant criticisms that kind of like, you know, throw up your hands. Yep, yeah, that is true. We are doing that. We need to fix this.
Yeah, and, you know, Protestants are the same, right? You know, so there is a whole, like, you know, there is a whole pan-Christian, if you like, push. You know, the Magdeburg Centurions, Cesare Baron. Like, there is a lot of initiatives, both on the Catholic front and on the Protestant front. The aims at purifying their respective confessions from falsity, to just sort out the wheat from the chaff, you know, what is true, what is not true, so that they can get stronger, because they cannot be accused from the other part of being credulous fools. You know, nobody wants to be credulous fools. And if they don't want that. They don't want to be perceived as such, and they do what it takes.
So they spend some time with this document, right? They're this whole case, right? The Curia has some, they have a hard time deciding what to do.
Yeah.
What's going on there? What's like, tell us about the process. What are they doing?
You know, some of the people in the Curia realize immediately that this is a whole bunch of BS, you know, baloney, like total fake. And so they want to shut it down. Other people say, well, it might be very well be true that this is not true. But at the same time, where do you draw the line? I mean, are miracles kind of true? Or does the truth of miracle always require, if you like, a suspension of judgment? Where do you draw the line? Mm-hmm. So that was the debate. Do you go hardcore, this is a fake, let's just shut it all up? Or do you really massage it because you are aware of the implications of that? So none of the people kind of like, you know, drank the Kool-Aid. But some of them were more forthcoming into shutting it out for the sake of the real truth, so to speak. Others were more for a solution of compromise. You know, he's a big guy in the Napolitan government. After all, there is a lot of miracles whose truthfulness cannot be verified by means of Hume. So are we sure we really want to go like call out and say this thing is fake? And so in that, they just failed to take a decision for decades. They just couldn't get rich.
I mean, and this is a political concern on their part too, right?
Very much like, so. Yeah. Very much so. You know, and again, you know, politics, and that's the other thing, you know, the Curia is a political body. Mm-hmm. They're in charge of, in fact, an incredible transnational, spiritual, but not just spiritual, empire. So political considerations are at the heart of the Curia's working. But political consideration doesn't mean being a credulous fool. They're not drinking the Kool-Aid. They're just thinking, hey, maybe this Kool-Aid serves some purposes in many ways. And let's be mindful of the ripple effects of the wider repercussions.
Yeah,
so, that doesn't make them stupid. You know, it makes them political leaders, which they were. I mean, think about the papacy in the pre-modern world was a political and a big one at that, you know, yeah, source of influence.
Naples is rich and important.
Naples is rich and important. And the relationship between Rome and Naples are not very harmonious, you know, because of the, yeah, you know, they are all, you know, they're all Catholic, you know, King of Spain is Catholic, you know, it's all good, but we're in the same team, but it doesn't mean that we always get along. And in fact, there is a long history of little, you know, fights and conflicts of jurisdiction, taxes between the papacy and the Kingdom of Naples. So do you really want to like make a big deal and piss off, you know, this big guy in the government of Naples for the sake of a guy that we all know is fake, but it's a nice story and it's very edifying because, you know, the saint does very good things. And so that's sort of the consideration that effectively prevents the member of the Inquisition from, or, you know, or the Index or the Curia from actually taking a stand. They are paralyzed. They don't know what to do, which is also very interesting.
I think it is. Well, because there's the idea that we are dealing with this very politically savvy, very kind of, that's an important thing to note about them anyway, that you're talking about a body of politicians as well as learned men and of men of faith. But then this other thing that like the tacit admission that some saints are fake, right? They're in the canon and they're wonderful and they're venerable and we're going to keep them because they're very important. But maybe this really didn't happen. Demonstrates just like a whole nother level of the utility, the thinking, the utilitas, what's, there's an adjective there that I'm not coming up with in English, the usefulness of sanctity. And
yeah, you know, Marx had a point, but you know, it wasn't the first one. I mean, you know, the sort of that kind of like utility of religion for the sake of other considerations is something that, you know, early modern leaders had very prevalent. I mean, there is an element of cynicism in it that people, you know, again, like you think about men of faith, right? My students, when they think about men of faith, they think they cannot be cynical. They have to believe but no, that's not the case. You know, you can, exactly. You have the men of faith, but you also have a little cynicism, call it cynicism, call it awareness of the functions of religion. You know, sanctity as a political function, as a liturgical function, but it's also as a, you know, cultural function. It's a civic function. Look at what happens today still in Italy when there is the feast of the patron saint in a city. It binds people together, which was all the more true in the early modern world. You know, now we have other venues to come together to express our identity. But at the time, you know, the feast of the patron saint was one of the most important one of them. So sanctity fulfills a lot of functions, including the theological one of, you know, providing a conduit between you and God. But the leaders of the church were aware of all of those functions. They just didn't deal, simply only with the theological one. They were very aware of the wider cultural, political, social, civic function of sanctity.
Sure. And also, as you mentioned, the didactic purposes, like this is a story we like.
This is a story we can, you know, like we can relate to because it's fun, you know, talk about sort of doctrinal, theological concepts to a bunch of people who are not literate or are semi-literate doesn't get you very far. But to give them an example, you know, to give them, you know, somebody to imitate, that is a different kind of didactic value to it. And so we run with it. And then we all, you know.
Yeah,
full of anecdotes of people from my students.
Absolutely. Let me tell you about this really exciting person. You could be like that.
Exactly. Well, you know, think about the idol. You know, I mean, I always, you know, my students are always very fascinated when I tell them the etymology of idol and talk about American Idol, you know, what it means, an idol, you know, to have idols, you know, to venerate somebody, the images of this perfection that is unattainable, but then once you have the image, then you can see it and you can strive to become like one. So I always tell them, watch out when you vote for American Idol.
This way.
You're voting about an idol. You're not just voting about the singer.
No, that's what you're doing. You're creating this cultural
force. Exactly. And so they go like, ooh.
Yeah. And they should be more careful. Mistakes have been made.
I'm pretty sure that, you know, being aware of who you pick as an idol is a very, very good lesson to have in life.
Absolutely. All right. So how does this all end? Tell me the rest of the story. So Carlo Cala makes up, he discovers the saint, like his fabulous ancestor who should be a saint. The curious just doesn't know what to do with it. They sit on it for a couple decades.
Yeah, they sit on it. He's, you know, sort of in the meantime, he thinks that this paralysis is good news. It means that they cannot decide, so he might as well go ahead. And then what he does is to start implementing or promoting actual veneration for this guy. And this is where he loses sort of, you know, the whole this game. Mm-hmm. Because as long as you're talking about a story of a saint, then you can have some uncertainty. You know, is it fake? Is it not fake? Is it useful? But once you start asking people to venerate somebody who most people knew never existed, let alone was a saint, then you're crossing a line. You're going from the world of discussing about this possible case to the world of actually having people pray to this guy. Mm-hmm. And this is where the Inquisition gets involved and they shut off the whole, they shut down the entire story of Giovanni. Nobody's allowed to talk about this guy, this ancestor, nobody's allowed to venerate him, but nobody's also allowed to tell the story anymore. And so that happens in a time where his political career, Carlo's political career, is also on a downward spiral because the viceroy changes and the new guy is not as friendly to him as the previous ones were. And so that ends sort of, you know, everything for him. His prestige, his political sort of push, his weight that he was used to throwing around, it's over. The one thing that we never find out is whether or not he was a victim of the fraud or he was the instigator of the fraud. Nobody, including myself, could establish with certainty whether he was in on it from the beginning or whether he believed in the story himself. He was the first victim of the fraud rather than the instigator of the fraud. We just don't know.
Who would have done that? Who would have been the instigator if it wasn't him?
I mean, there is the guy who actually materially forged all these documents. He was a local client, if you like, and he got a lot of money for it. So he fed to the Duke of Diano, Carlo Cala. He said, hey, you know, I found this document. I found this one. And there's another one. And there's another one. I found the bones. At some point, they even find the bones of this fake guy. And I found, you know, an image. And I found another story. And here is another manuscript. So it's either him out of his own volition to create a whole story just to please Carlo and to get the money, which he did. But there is another version of the story which Carlo and this guy kind of get together. Carlo tells this guy, can you fake stuff for me? And this guy went kind of overboard and started to fake in, you know, hundreds of pages of documents. But we just never know if it was his, you know, this local forger's initiative or if he was just a gun for hire. And by the time they discover the whole fraud, the forger is already dead. So they cannot interrogate him. They cannot ask him anything. They cannot put him on trial.
No. No. I would really like to hear what he had to say.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. You know, yeah. You and the Pope both. I mean, you know, there is a whole people in the Curia who wanted to like, hey, you know, let, you know, because they really were desperate to see, did Carlo tell you to do it? Or did you do it on your own accord? Because they would have changed the you know, the role of Carlo, mm-hmm. which throughout the story was always that of a promoter of a fake saint, not of the creator of a fake saint. Mm-hmm. So he was never punished insofar as he created the forgery. He was punished insofar as he made such a big deal out of the forgery that had the you know, presumed to force people to venerate somebody that the church said never anything about. They didn't say it was fake, but didn't say it was real either. So from the point of view of the church, it was a non-entity. He stayed in this limbo. And so people cannot venerate people that don't exist as a category, you know.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's interesting. I mean, and the fact he would have been a very easy sell, right?
If this, easy sell.
Yeah, this forger could have, you would have seen him come in a mile away. That makes sense.
Oh, yeah, that's the thing. Like, he was that obsessed. Carlo, everybody knew he was obsessed. I mean, you know, for all of his money that he accumulated, which he accumulated a lot, everybody knew he was obsessed. He wanted a noble lineage. It bothered him that he was a parvenu. He just wanted to be coming from a bigger family than he was. So, you know, you come to him and say, hey, I found your ancestor. He would be like, yeah, really? Yeah. What do I sign? Of course, I knew. I've always known it from, you know, from ever that I was better than this.
Yeah, obviously. It's inherent. See, you can tell. Yeah. Yeah, and it's interesting that when he pushes too far, but that's also, I mean, it's not coincidental that the church shuts it down when his power.
When he was down. Yeah. Again, you know, like, church is not stupid. You know, like, it's much easier to kick a man when he's down than when he's not. And so, you know, it was a sad ending to any... I mean, you have to feel for him, you know. Yeah. I mean, it is a story of scorned ambition, of the futility, if you like, of ambition, but it doesn't detract the kind of, like, human pain you almost feel for the guy. Like, you know, he had all this, you know, incredible ambition. He comes with nothing. I mean...
And he's got so much, but it's just not enough. Like, this is one of the tales we love in humankind.
See, right?
Motivating tale. We write fiction about this.
See.
Yeah, very cool. All right. So what's next? What are you working on now?
Oh, now I'm working on this book on credibility. So, you know, I've worked with uncertainty, I've worked with doubt, I've worked with truth, and now I have... I'm finishing this book on credibility and judgment, which is the other side of the coin, you know. So I usually, you know, in my past scholarly work, I've explored what happens when you don't have certainty. And this new book is about how do you get certainty when you can. And then after this is done, which is pretty soon, then I have another project, which I'm so excited about. And it's 1626, a year in the life of the Roman Inquisition. So, you know, 1626 is a very interesting year because you have a lot of sources on it. I'm not going to bore you, but there is like a lot of things on it. So, you know, exactly what happened in the whole year, all the correspondence that was written, all the cases that were dealt down to a T. And so I want to write a book to just tell people, like, what did the Inquisition do in this given year? And I also think the pandemic has taught us, you know, there is something exceptional about 2020, of course. But there is also something that is not exceptional in the sense that the pandemic, in fact, exacerbated dynamics that were already present, inequality about healthcare access or racial inequality or, you know, those things existed before, you know. So the pandemic brought them to the surface. So in 1626, in a way, was not an exceptional year. It was just a regular year. But stuff happened that year that didn't happen before or after. And so to focus on a whole year at the Roman Inquisition, I think, is a good exercise in what is really exceptional and what is really structural. Mm-hmm. What are the things that are that happen, that magnify a phenomenon, and what are the phenomena that are actually present throughout? So studying a year is a good test case study, you know, for that kind of what changes, what is exceptional, what is ephemeral, and what is structural, permanent, long. So I'm very excited.
That's very cool. I'm excited about that too. I love that idea.
So, you know, and then there will be like a chapter for, you know, there is a sort of a beginning of classification of what happened in the whole year, you know, the rhythm of the year, what happens in any given year. But then there are all these like chapters on the specific type of crimes and cases they dealt with. lots of sex, lots of money, you know.
Yeah.
Turns out money and sex, you know, in the form of bigamy or solicitation, you know, like sexual sins or marriage problems. Turned out that between that and money issue were the among the things that consumed most of the inquisitor's attention in a year.
Yeah, how about that? That's what humans do.
Yeah, indeed.
Oh, that's wonderful. Oh, Stefania, I've taken up quite enough of your time.
So oh, it was a pleasure. Jana, I'm really, thank you for talking to me.
It was fun. Really delightful. And really? I will be around. I will definitely be getting in touch. We'll talk about your next books too. So good. All right.
Ciao. Thank you so much.
Ciao, ciao.
Ciao.